Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids Podcast, where we explore what connects us all in our yoga practice and in our lives. This is where I talk to people about their stories, who they are, what they've been through, and where they're going. And in this podcast, that's what we explore. I believe deep down inside, we're all connected, which explains why we bring ourselves to the top of our mat every day. Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids. So welcome to the next edition of the Heartbreak Kids. I'm here with Dean Hollingsworth, and Dean is a good friend of mine. I've been to Dallas several times. We've been to Mysore together, or at least at the same time. I've got to know his family, and I've got to know his community quite well. And he's got an awesome story of recovery and also how yoga came into his life. And so, Dean, I am super honored to have you on the show today.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. Good to be with you. Thanks.
So let's get in. Yeah. So let's get into it. Let's talk a little bit about like your past and give the listeners a little bit of knowledge about where you started.
So I grew up in a small town, about an hour outside of Dallas, and, it was a rural town. And my family has a couple of farms. So after school each day, I would go out to the farms and spend a lot of time, out there.
Was it cattle farming?
Yeah. Cattle farming, horses, cattle and horses mainly. And, you know, we still go out there now. We go like camping and, fishing and all that kind of stuff. And it's a nice place to kind of retreat and get out of the city. So kind of had that kind of somewhat rural, but not completely rural, like upbringing, and, was real involved in sports, played everything that was offered, and did relatively well at most things. It was never the best, but I was, but I was pretty good. Good student, always had that going for me. I was always in the top of my class, made straight A's up until the point where drugs became, made my life really super unmanageable. Was in honors classes and things like that.
Did the drugs show up early for you?
I guess compared to some, I guess it was pretty early. So I was about 14. Yeah, 14, 15. So that is definitely pretty early. Now, I have three teenage kids that are 14, 15, and 19. And when I look back, I just can't believe that I was doing the stuff that I was doing at their age now. Wow. And I'm just like so grateful at like how healthy and, normal they are. And that life's not, life's not going that way for them. And, I felt so grown up and mature back then. But when I look at my own children, I'm like, wow, kind of blows my mind.
Yeah. I feel like sort of our generation had to grow up a little bit faster. Did you feel like you had to grow up faster?
For sure. So a little more of my backstory is, there was addiction in my home. And, with mom and dad, and parents got divorced when I was 7, primarily lived with mom and my younger brother. And that was always something that we saw, but when we were young, we didn't really, we didn't really know what it was. But as we grew older, we kind of realized like our home life was kind of different than a lot of our friends.
And because of the divorce or because of like there was a parent that was having addiction problem?
Yeah, because of the parents having the addiction problem. I mean, I guess the divorce a little bit too, but divorce is like pretty common, unfortunately. Yeah. So it was kind of the more the erratic behavior of like mom and dad. And so, there's always the question of like, is addiction genetic or is it like, environmental? Is it learned behavior? And so my brother and I had it like in both directions.
Gotcha. And so did your grades start failing and did you have trouble like completing school as a result of your addiction?
Yeah, I did. So this would have been in high school. So like the summer before I went into high school, I play music and I've been playing drums since I was 12 and I began playing in bands and a lot of that stuff went like hand in hand with the music scene. And I was, you know, in all these bands with guys that were older, that were outside of school, and I was just like a freshman. And it went pretty well to the junior year, and then slowly the drug use got progressively worse and harder. And eventually I just, it became like all consuming. And so I thought that, you know, I didn't need high school. I mean, all of this sounds ridiculous now, but at the time it somehow yeah. made sense. But I thought I would just drop out, get my GED and enroll in college. And I did all that, but then I got to college, and even though I had, you know, pretty, you know, strong aptitude for class and stuff, just my lifestyle was so erratic. And so I ended up like time after time, I'd enroll and, you know, be most of the way through a semester, and then I would just bomb because I couldn't show up. I couldn't keep a needle out of my arm.
Wow. And so when you're in college, like that's when you started putting a needle in your arm.
Let's see. Yeah, it was right in that time. So when I was about 17, you know, a lot of stuff happened at once. I dropped out of high school and, you know, and, began college, but also moved out as well. And so I got a full-time job, enrolled in college, and, had a couple of roommates. And through playing music, I was introduced to heroin on my 18th birthday, and I'd done pretty much most other drugs by then. But and then I remember when I did heroin, it was like this feeling of this is what I've been looking for in every other thing else that I've tried. I just didn't know it existed. And it felt like this is the way I want to feel forever, for the rest of my life.
Wow.
And yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I sort of had the exact same experience. I was like, this is like what I've been searching for my entire life. And the very first time I tried, it was freaking crazy.
Yeah. Oh, me too. I mean, it, yeah. Yeah. And then within like a year, you know, everything really fell apart. Like, so before my consequences for using, you know, were just kind of bad. They kind of interfered with relationships. I hadn't gotten any trouble with the law or anything like that. And, but nothing severe. But within like a year of heroin use, I was just miserable. Like every time that I would realize it was like a problem and I'd try to quit, then all of a sudden I would realize that there's this physical withdrawal that's associated with it with opiate use. And I would be just so miserable. And I realized, you know, really quickly that it could all go away if you just get high again. And so I got stuck in that loop. And then finally I realized like I couldn't do it on my own. So about the age of 19, I checked myself into treatment for the first time. And then I got in there, and I've been several times subsequently after that, but I went in there and I got about 30 days into it, and I was like, okay, I'm a pretty smart guy. Like, I got the drill. Like, don't use drugs. You don't have to like come back to a place like this.
Yeah.
And this was in Houston, and I came back to Dallas, and within like 48 hours, I was high again because I had made absolutely no changes in my life. I had just, you know, essentially hit like a pause button on my using. So came back into the, I still had my own place, and I came back to that. I still had my same peer, my friend group, wasn't tied into any 12 steps or anybody in recovery. So it should have been no surprise.
Yeah.
That I got high again.
It's
yeah.
It's really hard to like come back to old situations, especially when you don't have the support of a sobriety network. You know, it's like really hard. I mean, so it's not surprising really.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it would be amazing if you did stay clean, you know, if like right. if self-knowledge would keep us clean, you know, there wouldn't be many addicts walking around probably.
You know? Totally. And so yeah. What happened after that?
So that's when everything really started to go to hell. Within like the next, I don't know, 6 months to a year, I got my first two felonies, for heroin possession, and, you know, was put on probation, and then somehow, got like another chance again on the second one. And, then, you know, I just became intertwined in like the legal system. And, I, you know, even though I knew I was facing prison time, I couldn't get clean. Like I just couldn't stay clean, even though
And this was all just heroin too? This was all just heroin?
Yeah. Fun. Later on, I kind of like took detours and, you know, I did like 3 or 4 years where I used a bunch of methamphetamines. But for the most of the time during my using, it was always heroin.
Wow.
And, so yeah, at some point, you know, I was bouncing in and out of like detoxes and rehabs and things got, you know, really ugly. I mean, like kind of the stuff that's in like movies and stuff. I ended up, homeless and like on the streets and just living out of a backpack. And it didn't even have to be that way. I mean, like I could have, you know, attempted to get sober and like my family would help me, but they had just kind of witnessed the pattern so much that they were unwilling to help me if I wasn't willing to help myself. And I was just at this miserable, dark place where I guess I wasn't done, you know?
Yeah.
And I was okay with the darkness and being in these places and, you know, sleeping on couches, sleeping in garages, you know, just all that crap that goes along with that.
Yeah. And so did your family basically have to walk away from you?
Yeah, somewhat. And so I guess because I wasn't the first one who's dealt with addiction in my family or alcoholism, they never completely turned their back. But it was just the thing is like, you know, they weren't going to help me with money. I couldn't stay there if I wasn't being clean. But they were always supportive if I was willing to like help myself. Like they would always like answer the phone or, you know, I could still come over. But yeah, but I was kept at arm's distance, I guess.
Yeah, it's a really hard period, it sounds like. I mean, I can totally relate because, you know, my family and my drug addiction took me into crack houses and all of these different places that, you know, now looking at it, it's like, how was I even there? You know, like, how did I show up at this place and be okay with, like, you know, my life just being, you know, like put down the drain, you know, on a consistent basis. So it sounds like a really tough period.
Yeah, it was. It's crazy. Like when I look back now, because it's been so much time, it seems it's almost just like a bad movie that I saw a long time ago, you know, a bad movie that was like my life for like 15 or 20 years.
Wow. Yeah. I can totally relate to that too.
Things continued to get worse, actually, and I eventually like couldn't get sober, violated probation like repeatedly, and they tried to give me like several chances, and eventually I got some more charges, some more felonies, and ended up doing 2 years in prison behind all this, and then believe it or not, got out, you know, stayed clean for about 9 months and then started getting high again.
Jeez.
And, so the saga continued, you know, more years.
And I think normal people are basically like, are like, how does someone do that? You know, like after witnessing and spending time in prison and having these consequences, it's like normal people can't even relate to it.
Yeah, it's tough. Recently, a friend of mine's son just committed suicide recently. And I kind of was left with the thought after thinking about this for a while. It's like in probably the same way people don't understand addiction who aren't addicts, I probably don't understand the level of depression that like this young man was under when he took his life, because it just doesn't make sense to me. Yeah. You know, how that could happen. And I've seen the same looks on people's faces when they're like, well, you know, your life wouldn't be shit if you just didn't put a needle in your arm.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, man, that's a tough realization. I feel the same way. It's like, you know, there's so many people out there struggling with whatever it is, and it's really hard to find that empathy. And, you know, if you haven't experienced it before, because basically, like, you know, right now we're trading war stories. Like your story sounds exactly like mine. You know, but the, you know, the person who, recently passed away, it's like, you know, they probably didn't have anyone to relate to and didn't make it to the other side. And so I totally feel that.
So, yeah.
So what did your worst day drinking and using look like? What was the worst day for you?
Oh man, I don't know about worst days. You know, it took so many different shades of like, you know, horribleness. But like one of them that just pops to mind, like initially when I was, in a particularly kind of sad low point, was like, I was unemployable. I didn't have a, place of my own to stay. So I was living out of a backpack. I had gotten to the point of like stealing stuff to like go sell or pawn to get high. And I remember at the peak of it, that I was doing like 2 grams of heroin a day. And so I was spending like $200, and my tolerance was so high, I was trying to somehow melt down like a half a gram into a spoon and pull it up. And it was just like so thick. And like, that's enough right now. All of us being sober, it would kill, a whole room of us.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just, little fractions of that, but my tolerance was just so high. It's kind of like when you hear alcoholics, you can say, well, I drink more, or they drink more than like a case of beer,
Right.
And so I just remember doing that, and I was underneath, I was like scared that I was going to overdose and like not even be high, but my system just shut down because it's like so toxic. Then I just remember like crying because I couldn't get high. And I was that far gone, and I just had that like kind of little moment of like clarity, like this is just so crazy what's going on. And unfortunately, it's like through all those things, all those different consequences, it was like never sufficient to make me really, do what was necessary to get clean.
So how did you wind up finally making the decision to clean up your life and get sober?
That's a great question. It wasn't like I've had all these really dramatic consequences in my life, and it wasn't any of those things. I just like grew so tired. I grew so miserable. Maybe if I had been like the more depressive type or identified with like suicide, I probably would have done that. And I have 2 brothers, one that's close in age, and we grew up together, and he had been clean for about 2 years. His story is like kind of mirrors both of ours. And he had been clean for like 2 years, and I knew that the level of which he used was like me, and very dramatic and not just your average, kind of using situation. And so I knew like if he could do it, then there was a good chance that I could too. And I just kind of tapped out. I just remember like calling him up and being like, okay, man, like I'm ready. I'm miserable. And I just don't want to continue on this way. Like for a long time, there was always this preconceived notion of like going into 12-step meetings and like, that just looked like it sucked. Talking about how you used to get high, talking about how you used to get high, you used to like have fun and sitting around and like drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes with a room full of people that aren't using drugs anymore. And so it was just this whole picture I'd painted in my head, and so I avoided it like the plague. But finally I just became willing, I guess, through all this addiction, it just kind of like eroded me down. And on that very first day when I had called my brother, I'd walked into my first, I don't know if it was my first, but I walked into a 12-step meeting, and then I walked into my first yoga class on the same day. Wow. And I didn't stay clean from that day forward. And I also, obviously didn't keep with practicing yoga, but both of those seeds were planted that day.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that is crazy, man. It's how mirrored our lives are. It's like,
I remember when I was reading your book, I was like, oh crap, he's telling my story. This is it, And ever since then, like felt like a great connection to you, because I felt like we had just similar journeys, just in different parts of the country,
Yeah, it's pretty crazy too. And for the listeners that, and a lot of people don't know this, but you read one of the first drafts of my story, which was kind of cool. And someone like kind of made that introduction for me and like introduced us. And then you read the first draft, and I was like, I need someone who's outside of my circle to read this, so that it, to see if I'm on the right track. And I remember you sent him feedback, or we talked or something like that. And you were like, yeah, you're on the right track, man. It's like it need, you were, I, and you've also said like it still needs to go through the editing process. I was like, yeah, I know that was the rough draft, bro. It was the first draft. I really think it was the first draft. So it's crazy.
I'm probably a little bit of a literary snob. I mean, one of the things about having a good, you know, semi-good education and then also being in prison 2 years is I'm pretty well read. So.
What else is kind of feels good is that, you know, we're both able to like laugh about these really difficult periods of our lives, because, you know, I laugh about mine too. And I think people don't really understand that, but it feels so far gone. I don't feel like that person today, you know? And so it's okay for me to like laugh about it, even though that what I share at like Dharma talks or in my book is like super, you know, it's heavy. You know, and some of the stuff that you said is heavy, but like we're able to laugh about it and we're able to have a good life in spite of the things that have happened to us, you know, or that we've done to ourselves also. So
sure. So in 2 months in February, it'll be 10 years since last, you know, using heroin. I remember when I first, I had like a year and a half, but even before that, and then relapsed and went out for about a year and a half. So it was about 13 years ago. But I remember right off the bat, like I was asked to speak when I was about a year clean at a treatment center. And man, I was just mortified. And I was like, well, you know, I don't know what I could possibly say that would help anybody, and still had a whole bunch of the guilt and shame that I'd let myself and my family down, and I'd went through these really dark things that I definitely didn't want to talk about in front of a group of people. And then over time, as I began to share my story more, and eventually had a H&I commitment with going into hospitals and institutions, I began to realize that what was like my greatest liability has in this world become like the greatest asset, is that I can sit down with a group of guys that are addicts that are struggling and have done some things they're not proud of. And by me opening up first, talking about how I've stolen stuff, how I've done things I thought I would never do before, and then recovered from it, that they're really comfortable talking about what's really going on in their life. And it creates a connection that just like a normal person, or maybe a counselor who's not an addict, doesn't have with that person. And so along the way, you know, guys like you and I, because we've been through this together, we can definitely laugh about it because we relate. And now it just seems like ludicrous, ridiculousness, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And so tell me about your first yoga class. So, you know, did you walk into an Ashtanga class? Like, what was your feeling? Like, did you like it? Like, had you ever done anything like that? I mean, just tell us like a little bit about the feelings that kind of came up with your first initial yoga class.
Okay. So yeah, first yoga class, it was a great one. It was not Ashtanga. So, my brother's a photographer, and it was early in his career. And it was at his mentor's space. It was like a photography studio, and this other guy was there. His name's Chinook. And if you're from Dallas and you've been practicing yoga for a while, you probably know who Chinook is. And so it was a donation-based class. And this guy was just the guy I needed right then. He talked like he was from the streets and dropped F-bombs and said, you know, MFers and things like that. And it wasn't like candy coated, and we weren't talking about heart chakras and inner children and stuff like that. And so like, I connected with this guy, and, I could listen to what he was saying. And I just remember one thing in particular is that I don't know what the pose is called, because it's not really an Ashtanga thing, but you lay on your back, you draw one knee in and one leg straight, and then you do a twist, right? And I just remember tears running down my face, because my body was just so like damaged and dirty and toxic. And I'd probably never stretched like that before in my life. And I just remember feeling of like how therapeutic doing these movements and breathing was. And, it was drawn back to it. So again, like the seed was planted that day.
Yeah. That's awesome. And so how did you find your way to an Ashtanga yoga class?
Okay. So, I'm going to back up just slightly. So after I was clean a couple of years, I had the idea that I wanted to become a teacher. I was going to yoga classes sporadically, but I wanted to do like a teacher training so that I could go into treatment centers and work with people that were getting clean as well, because it was being so helpful and beneficial to me. And during teacher training, we tried like all the different styles of yoga, or, you know, most of them. And we did Ashtanga, and my teacher had studied with Manju back in the day. And when we were in Surya Namaskar B, I was thinking to myself, what is this yoga again? Ashtanga? Like, I will not be doing this, you know? Like, I wasn't into yoga to sweat. And, you know, it was more, very much more like meditative and very kind of basic and elemental at that point. And I was into kind of working out, and I had just gotten into like long distance running at this point. And so finished teacher training, went to treatment centers and taught like a really gentle kind of hatha yoga for a few years. And then along the way, I began to run marathons. And so, you know, when you're out there running long distances, you have this quiet place that you can like fall into, you know, like mentally. And it's almost kind of like what they talk about, like moments of clarity. So often if I was struggling with something, like the answers would come out on these long runs. And also I improved my breathing. And I think it was important for me as well, because after all this time of like addiction and having this undisciplined life, I was proving to myself that I could do these things that maybe I once thought was like impossible. And so I was kind of increasing the thresholds of what I could do, like mentally and physically. And so along the way, I ran into Ashtanga again. So there was some offerings here in Dallas. There was a few people that were kind of holding space, but there wasn't like a full program. Some of the classes were at this guy, Jeff's house, who's become a mentor to me, and we would go practice all together. And like the first time I walked in there, he was like, okay, everybody, we're going to do second series. And it was like a follow the leader second series. It was like my first class over at his place. And I'm trying to like stick my leg behind my head and, you know, so anyway, between that and then some other studios had some lead primary. And, what I really liked about it when I came back to it again was that I couldn't do it. Like I couldn't do Lotus. I couldn't do, you know, any of the harder gateway postures in primary series. I couldn't, you know, lift up and jump back. But I liked it. I liked the way I felt afterwards. And then as I began to do it more, I also found that little mental quiet place that I used to find on these long runs. And that really resonated with me. And I loved the way I felt afterwards. And then when I began to like dig in online, I was like, oh, okay, I've just been working through, you know, primary series. And it looks like there's six series and I can't even do the first one. This is great. And then I started digging into the philosophy of it. And then I realized like how big the scope was of it. And it really just intrigued me and drew me in.
Wow. That's crazy. I mean, also that you walked into a second series class, like those things are hard as hell.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like I had a knot in my back for like a day or two afterwards because I was able to stick my leg behind my head, but without like any kind of integrity, you know, and not knowing what to engage and what to relax. So it was like the Unabanda, like everything was just gripped, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Use your neck. Yeah.
Like, yeah. Right.
Yeah. So what was your, I mean, why did you really like the challenge though? I mean, I don't know, you know, because this is, I feel like something that's unique to Ashtanga yoga, and you kind of mentioned it, but like, can you talk a little bit more about it? Like, why did that like kind of draw you in?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not 100% sure, but my guess is that, you know, in recovery, we talk about how, you know, when you're using, you know, you're definitely not disciplined in like the day to day, you know, addict's lifestyle is not a disciplined existence. And,
You know, it could have been a martial arts class maybe that I walked into and grabbed me and grabbed my attention, but it just happened to be Ashtanga. And I like the discipline aspect of it. I like the going deeper into it and learning more about it.
But you couldn't do any of it. And so, you know, I feel like nowadays, I feel like everyone gravitates towards the things that they're good at. You know, like maybe if you were a handstander, you would have walked into a handstand class and you would have found it. But, you know, there's something inherently spiritual about what I feel like our practice is. And so did that draw you in? And also the aspect of that you couldn't do it, that you felt some sort of ambition to get it or something?
Man, it was all the above. It's a complex question, but when I walked into Jeff's place, he has this, this place above his old garage, and we would go up there before the sun was up, and there's the smell of Mysore rugs hanging over the balcony of sweat, and it's dimly lit and incense. And, you know, this opening mantra that I don't understand is that Sanskrit? You know, I don't even know. So, but I feel this there's a spirituality to the whole thing. And then on the physical level, I've always kind of been of the mind that if somebody else can do something, and not just on the physical level, but with anything, but if somebody else can do something, then I feel pretty confident that if I devote myself and practice, that I can do it too. And so I wasn't daunted by the fact that I couldn't express the poses yet. It really just kind of made me hungry to dive into it so that I could get to that point. Gotcha. But yeah, you know, it's so multifaceted. It's not just it's never been just about one thing. I mean, it's hitting the physical, mental, and spiritual. And all that was really enticing at that point in my life and still is, you know.
Yeah, it's, it's a very complex question. I ask it, often because, there's so many different aspects of it. Some people are totally drawn to the spiritual side of the practice and they're there's, components that make us feel connected to our body and connected to other people and all that stuff. And then there's other people that are the challenge is what kept me interested in the damn thing. Or the use of my body where it becomes very just a physical practice, almost like fitness. And so it's really interesting to hear all these different perspectives as they kind of come up for people. Because for me, I was kind of into the fact that I couldn't do it because it meant that I had something to strive for. And when you start seeing progress, and I'm sure you can totally relate to this, but you start seeing progress and you're holy crap, look at this. I'm a drug addict who's living on the streets. And now all of a sudden, I'm watching these things progress in my life and life mirrored my map. I was holy crap, I'm doing this. And also look at I'm looking at life a completely different way because I'm able to see my progress in this area. It's intense and it's amazing and I love it. You know, and that's part of the reason why it drew me in.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, I guess one thing that I, didn't mention you've hit upon here is your self-worth. And so after all these years of, beating myself up and doing things that I'd like to do was, guilty or felt guilty about and ashamed to even talk about, getting into the running again and pushing and finding new limits. There's some kind of axiom that when I'm doing this stuff and then also at the same time, I'm out there in the 12-step community, I was sponsoring guys, I was going to treatment centers every week and speaking. And then at the same time, I'm developing a 6-day-a-week practice and all these things are happening. I began to feel good about myself again. And exploring new areas of me, shining a light into new places of Dean that I've never looked before and definitely never seen as an adult. And it just seems it just rippled out into all aspects of my life. So the funny thing is, and now as a teacher, of course I'm witnessing it all the time, but we show up thinking we're doing sun salutations and trying to get Marichyasana D, but along the way, it disciplines your life. You start paying attention to what you eat, what time you go to sleep, who you're hanging out with.
how you're talking to other people, because like when you get into arguments or you lie or you steal or something like that, it makes it really hard to sit with yourself in meditation when you've been a jerk or dishonest or something, you know? And so, it, you know, Ashtanga kind of tricks you in, or at least it has for me, of like, ironing my life out. And while I'm just thinking of like, I'm trying to work on like the next pose or whatever's keeping me hungry when I'm on the mat. But at the same time, life is getting better in like all these different directions.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great insight. Because I feel the exact same way. And so talk about how you made the decision to go to Mysore, India for your first time.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Okay. So, here in Dallas, we had some great teachers at the time, but there was no one who had been to India. You know, no one was authorized and there wasn't a full program. And so, you know, I would take as much as I could with the local teachers. And after I kind of got, you know, into it, I started, you know, tuning into the bigger Ashtanga world. And I was like, okay, there's this guy, Tim Miller in California. There's Richard Freeman in Boulder. There's David Swenson. And when I found out he lived in Austin, it's like 3 or 4 hours away. It's like, okay, I'm going to go do the Fight Club thing and like sleep on this guy's doorstep until he accepts me as a student. But, but he's never at home. Like he doesn't, you know, he doesn't run a regular shala there. So, and so when I started looking into wanting to go study for like a month or something, I realized, I looked at the cost and I was like, for the same cost or maybe a lot less, I could go to India and study with Pattabhi Joyce's grandson. And after I had that idea in my head, I kind of sheepishly went to my wife and was like, hey, so there's this guy in India, you know, I'd like to go study with. And so I guess after some talking and, you know, she watched the whole, the growth of all this in my life and kind of saw the ripple effect. And she's just that kind of supportive partner that was like, okay, like do it. And then just turns out, right about the end, she ended up coming with me as well. And she studied with Saraswati on that first trip and I studied with Sharat. But, yeah, so it was one of those things where it was just, there wasn't anybody who was like more senior, who was really, you know, had a full program here. And so I just decided to go and meet him and study with him. And I made a meeting with him before I left on that first trip and kind of explained the situation here in Dallas and said, you know, should I find somebody in the US to study with, like an authorized teacher, or should I, you know, if I can, should I continue to make the effort to come back here? And should I consider you my teacher or look for one? And he just kind of like nodded his head and he was like, yes, you know, it has already begun. Like, you know, you're my student. And, it was really kind of a touching moment. And so, I've been making annual trips back ever since then.
Wow. That's freaking awesome. I mean, and also the fact that, you know, like someone who was couch surfing, put needles in their arm, is like, you know, made it to what you're doing today. And also being like a beacon of hope for people and like sharing the message of not only, you know, 12 steps, but also sharing the message of what Ashtanga yoga has to offer people. It's really, you know, it's inspiring for me to watch the things that you've done, you know, during that period of time too. So,
thank you. Thank you for saying that. So, you know, we're at the cusp of the year right now, and then also at the cusp of the decade. And so I've recently been thinking like all of these things happened because we planted these seeds. You know, all of these things that we're doing now, you and I, they were just intentions initially, right? They were just thoughts. And sure. And then we've kind of nurtured them. They became intentions, and intentions became like preparations and actions. And then that's evolved into becoming to like what our reality is. And so I've got a big dry erase board at the shala, and I've just been asking students, like, what's your intention? What's your intention for the new year, for the new decade? Because you can manifest any of these things. Like if a guy like me can get sober, and like, you know what the recidivism rate is and the relapse rate is again for people that are opiate addicts, and it's low. I mean, back in the day when I was paying attention to it, it was less than 10%.
And like, if guys like us can get sober, not only get sober, but like, look at where we're going. You know, we've got families, we've got children that are living healthy lives, good relationships, shawless, you know? And so I'm just trying to challenge the people that I'm around as well, is like, think ahead. Like, you can do anything you want. Just begin to think it, begin to manifest it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about your shala. You know, so when I came for the first time and the other visits, we were going to a different school. And recently you started your own school. And so tell me what the learning curve has been about, like, been about this year. And tell me how, like, opening up your own shala and, you know, having a traditional program and doing it on your own has been this year.
Yeah, man, it's been so much. You know, I didn't, you know, before I was only teaching, I was teaching the program at a Dallas Yoga Center here in Dallas. And, it was a great place to be, but I just kind of wanted a little bit more freedom to kind of expand and grow in other areas that I wasn't available to do there. And so that was kind of the impetus to kind of do our own thing. But yeah, there's so much to it. You know, it's like I've gotten pretty comfortable with being like a Mysore teacher, although that I'm constantly learning. Like, that's, I don't think that's ever going to end. But now I'm looking But now I'm looking at like, how do I manage like a small business? How do I run a studio? And not only do like, how do I do these things, but how do I do these ethically in a way that, you know, that corresponds with my values. And then, you know, I realize all the things that I'm not great at, you know, like I'm not great at like sales and marketing and accounting and, you know, advertising. And so it's making me look at other things like that, or not just me, but Sarah and I, my wife, as well. And so this year has been full with a lot of that. So, yeah, it's kind of ironic. It's like I'm making less money at the moment than I've made in, I don't know, like a long time, years. But I've never been as satisfied as I am right now. And I see things picking up, like things are growing. But you know, most small businesses take like a couple of years. They say, you know, the common wisdom is a plan not to pay yourself for a couple of years. So, you know, right off the bat, that wasn't the case. So, I'm already ahead of the curve there, but, yeah, there's been so much to like wrap my head around this year. And it just seems like it doesn't end at the shala. It's not like a 9 to 5. Like, yeah. So Sarah and I are lying in bed at night talking about like, well, we're going to get these emails out. We've got a plan for 2020, you know, talking about this and that. And so in addition to, you know, having a family as well, I mean, it's pretty consuming.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a lot of aspects of business and marketing and all branding and, you know, like all of these accounting, all of these things that are really difficult. It's like, I just wanted to be a Mysore teacher and all of a sudden like you become like, you know, a business.
Yeah, right. Right.
It makes it really difficult. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, because I always kind of like to end the conversation with, you know, some insight of why you continue to practice today. And so what drives you to show up at your mat on a consistent basis and continue to do this practice?
Yeah, that's a big question. Also like a multifaceted, because, you know, it changes all the time. Or at least it does for me. So I have like new realizations, new insights into, you know, why am I doing this? One of the analogies that's come to my head recently is I have this thought that like I live up on top of this like hill or mountain. And so every day, you know, I need water or sustenance, right? And so I'm picturing myself like walking down the mountain or the hill with like the stick, and on the ends there's like a pail on each side. And so I've got to like scoop 2 pails of water and then like walk back up the hill to bring the sustenance like back home. And that's kind of my practice. The way I kind of view it as well is like, often it seems like it's just this really hard. Some days it seems like it's the same thing over and over.
and, you know, I'm looking at the same things. But always when I get back again, I find that it feeds me. When I get to the other side of it afterwards, I'm always grateful that I've had the practice and I feel sustained and nurtured. Wow.
That's beautiful, man. Well, I want to really thank you for being on the show and sharing your heart and your story. And, you know, your family, you and Sarah and your kids have been wonderful to me each time that I've been there. And I appreciate all your work that you're doing for the Trinity Foundation. It means a lot to me, and it means a lot to the people that, you know, obviously, like, who are struggling with addiction still today. And so I just, you know, I'm really honored. I'll be back to Dallas to visit your space and to teach a workshop in late June of 2020. And I'm really excited for that. But Dean, I really appreciate you not only being on the show, but being a friend.
Oh, man, it's been my pleasure. It's so nice to be sharing this path with you, and especially early on. I remember when you asked me to read this draft. It was a feeling of familiarity. It was like, okay, you know, Taylor has also walked this path, and look at what he's doing. You know, he's got a shala. His life is leveled out, seems happy and successful. And it was like, okay, you know, Taylor's doing this. And so it was kind of like, you know, you were further down the path and holding this lamp light up and kind of like leading the way. And so thank you very much for saying all those kind things, but thank you also for kind of being a beacon of light and a hope for me as well. So I really appreciate your inspiration and your friendship on the path.
Thanks, Dean.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in. If you want more information about Ashtanga Yoga, visit ashtangayogacolumbus.com. You can also check out my website, which is taylorhuntyoga.com. See you guys next time.